From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. On today's dialogue, we're in conversation with Dr. Marley Bunge. She's an author, educator, and scholar. She has a PhD in diversity and equity in education from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
When you're in the classroom and you have students from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds, how do you create lessons and activities that acknowledge the differences amongst your students?
Today, we'll be learning about her work and research. It encompasses the oral histories of Black female educators. And we'll be diving into her recent book, The Magnitude of Us, and how she takes this framework from past educators and uses it in today's classrooms to create more equity and cultural competency. Through her work in the education space, she's made connections with Dr. Christopher Spann. He's not only a mentor and colleague to Dr. Marley Bunge, but he's an author and historian. He's also the former chief of staff and associate chancellor for pre-K through 12 for the chancellor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's going to be joining the conversation now to share a bit of historical context and the overall history of our experience in the American education system. Dr. Christopher Spann, thank you so much for joining us on Dialogue today.
No, thank you.
Can you break down to listeners a bit of history and provide a timeline of the education system in America? What is it like, historically speaking, being Black in the American education system?
The history of American education really begins when the nation began as its colonies. So Massachusetts was its first colony. And public education took root literally years right after the founding of that colony. The most important creation was education would be at the expense of the public. Property tax or local taxation, you would have support for public education. Now, with African Americans, they were almost exclusively denied any formal public schooling opportunities during this time period, before and well into the 20th century. And so it would only be with the advent of the Civil War that you would see African Americans during the Civil War really start to flee the institution of slavery. The majority of African Americans were enslaved. And in the process of fleeing the institution of slavery, it really broke the backbone of the Confederacy that led a war against the United States. And in the immediate years following the Civil War, in what we call the Reconstruction years or the Emancipation years, you would see African Americans argue for education at the public expense for everyone. And they would literally, as new voting citizens, write that into the constitutions in Southern states. So what Horace Mann would have started in Massachusetts that spread north of slavery westward, it would be former slaves, African Americans who were formerly enslaved, that would create that push in the American South westward. And so that's pretty much the summation of the 19th century. But African Americans attending school on an equal basis in the 20th century wouldn't happen until approximately a decade to a decade and a half after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, which was 70 years ago.
You're also an author. You wrote Sam's Cottonfield Blues and Quest for Book Learning, African-American Education in Slavery and Freedom. You provided really powerful examples of the rhythm and style of the African-American educational heritage. Can you break that down for us and explain the experience and role of Black Americans in the education system?
African-Americans in general, despite the fact that they had been denied education for 2.5 centuries that slavery existed, and then only provided, you know, a bare bone minimum education for 100 years after that. They are really the architects of education in America. And so it's arguable that the people most denied freedom and most denied literacy and access to schools are the ones that appreciated all of the above the most. And so you'd have a number of people who would be the forefront of pushing and advancing education. So you have Frederick Douglass, for example, who'd be enslaved in Maryland. You know, he's pretty much self-taught. He was, as a child, he learned how to become literate by tricking young white children who were allowed to go to school to show him their class lessons. Bet I can write that letter A better than you, or I bet I can, you know, spell this word better than you. And what child isn't going to accept a challenge, right? So here's Douglas kind of pushing that envelope to become self-taught. But he was probably roughly 5 to 10% of enslaved African-Americans who use these kind of opportunities to educate themselves. And when emancipation came universally following the Civil War, 5 to 10% would become the teachers of that first generation of emancipated people in mass number. And they would work alongside Northerners who went south to aid the freed people or to educate them, or Southerners who were sympathetic or truly believed that African Americans should be part of the American social order. And so it was in that combination that you would see the illiteracy rate of African Americans go from roughly 90 odd percent in the 1860 census to roughly less than 20% in the 1900 census. So you almost eliminated illiteracy in the African American community. And by the time you get to the 20th century, you have Jim Crow, segregation by law, which also severely restricted access to public schools. You'd have schools for whites and schools for colored children. You would see those signs that were out there. Most African Americans weren't allowed in the southern states, where Jim Crow was pretty much sanctioned by law, to attend school beyond the eighth grade. So very few high schools existed for African Americans throughout that region. So if you take the essay, The Quest for Book Learning, or you take address that I wrote, Sam's Cottonfield Blues, you can see wrapped up in there many African Americans who never really got beyond the eighth grade in learning, but they had a lot of common wit. They had a lot of genius in every possible category under the sun. They didn't have the credential, but they had the knowledge and they had the experience. And I think that's what you would see as the civil rights movement would begin to shake shape, is that people who had been long denied an education now was out front and center in the streets demanding that their children and grandchildren receive an education.
Dr. Spann, we've been talking about the historical aspects of the education system in America. Moving this knowledge forward, what is something that should be integrated in every education course in America to promote children's learning and awareness?
Honestly, it would be African American history. James Baldwin said it best. If you know the history of African American experience, then you know the history of America.
Do you think certain aspects of today's education system have failed us, especially children of color?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. And the schools, in some ways, they don't account for difference. We still are trying to educate children in ways that don't complement their fullest way they comprehend knowledge, but even more importantly, the way they express their understanding confidently of knowledge. And so we have to be able to have more adaptive ways, particularly at the early childhood and elementary grades, to get children excited about wanting to share what they know. And there shouldn't be a penalty for them wanting to kind of be expressive in this moment, as long as it's kind of enhancing the curiosity in the room. That teachers should be able to understand how to facilitate that kind of energy and channel it and move it in the right direction. And if they're not, this is where professional development comes into play. And I didn't describe anything that doesn't already exist. This is the foundational model for Montessori schools or project learning approach, that they don't sit in kind of rows and learn through rote memorization. They're there to explore literally a concept and what that concept would mean from start to finish. So you could have a concept like, how does this food get to someone's grocery store? And it literally starts with the seed and understanding that this is germination and it moves all the way up. And these kids are learning this in important ways, and everyone has a chance to contribute in their own meaningful way. And so we have to be more flexible within the models of instruction that we have in our schools to enhance the pool of individuals who are not only learning the competency skills that they have, but they're doing it in confident ways. sometimes in the United States, we have very confident people, but they're not very competent people. And the best combination is a very competent, confident person. And so I think that to me is where we need to have those models of flexibility. And we know they exist across the country. We just need to incorporate those in spaces that we know they don't exist, because that's where we've had our greatest success in education.
You're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Right now, we're in conversation with Dr. Christopher Spann. He's an author, historian, and the former chief of staff, and associate chancellor for pre-K through 12 for the chancellor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's sharing with us a bit of historical context to African Americans and the history of our experience in the American education system. Coming up next on Dialogue, we're centering our conversation around historically marginalized voices and perspectives in education. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Marley Bunch. She's an author, educator, and alum from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's going to be sharing with us her latest book, The Magnitude of Us, and how she uses her research of Black female educators from the past and how to apply their lessons in today's classrooms. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. On today's Dialogue, we're in conversation with Dr. Marley Bunch. She's an author, educator, and scholar, and has a PhD in diversity and equity in education from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
When you're in the classroom and you have students from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds, how do you create lessons and activities that acknowledge the differences amongst your students?
Right now, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Christopher Spann. He's Dr. Bunch's mentor and former colleague. Dr. Christopher Spann is an author and historian. He's the former chief of staff and former associate chancellor for pre-K through 12 for the chancellor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Both join us in conversation right now to talk about the mentorship and connection that they've created within education. Dr. Spann, tell me about the collaboration and mentorship that you've created with Dr. Marley Bunch through your passion for knowledge and education and research. How crucial is this in academia?
I don't believe we can get too far in society and life without mentorship. I'm a product of that experience. As I work with my students, Dr. Bunch included, I very much want to be very present in their lives and careers. And I don't just want to see them advance professionally speaking. I want them to understand the balance of what it would take to advance professionally, but also be that person who has a family and attend to their family, to not be consumed in one direction or the other, but to try to think about the work-life balance. Sometimes you work so hard that you forget to smell the roses, so they speak, or to make phone calls with family members and loved ones, and all of a sudden you assume they'll always be there, and then they're not. I remember losing my mom when my son was born, and I always thought that I would have her forever. It never crossed my mind that I would lose her, right? So when I work with my students and I see them, anxiety is real. Wanting to accomplish great things and be excellent is real. When I see them putting so much emphasis on that, I always try to ask them the question, well, how's your family doing?
Dr. Marley Bunch, I want to bring you into this conversation and ask you what it's like to be a mentee of Dr. Christopher Spann and the power of what you've learned so far.
I think just to build a little bit off of what Dr. Spann just spoke about, I think dismantling this idea of who belongs in higher ed, in spaces of writers and authors and thinkers is really, really important. I didn't know it was so central to my work, but it definitely is. And as he mentioned, the different ways in which you can tell a story. I love art. I love poetry. So I think somehow they'll always find their way into my work. And they were always a part of my teaching when I was in the classroom. But yeah, so I think what an honor to have Dr. Spann write. Someday I'm going to convince him to co-author a book with me. but we'll wait for that. But what an honor, because I think, you know, we talk about serendipity, and I think Dr. Spann and I share similar ways in which we grew up and were able to kind of do things that maybe others wouldn't have expected of us, you know? And so when you're, I think, a Black person in our country and you are fighting against poverty and racism and just all of the things, you know, growing up in not a good neighborhood. And so I think it's just such a, like, to see his name on a book or an essay with mine is absolutely the highest honor, you know, for me.
Dr. Spann, thank you so much for having this dialogue with Dr. Marley Bunch and I.
No, thank you.
You're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Right now, we are going to speak with Dr. Marley Bunch herself. One of many accomplishments of Dr. Bunch has been being the creator of the UnHush framework. HUSH standing for Histories, Unlearning, Stories, and Healing, which is a framework for teachers to use in the classroom to create more equity and cultural competency. This framework was designed based on Dr. Bunch's own research on the oral histories of Black female educators. Dr. Bunch is the author of two books, The Magnitude of Us and Unhushing Us, and both of these books cover how educators can better center historically marginalized voices and perspectives in their work. And today, we're starting the conversation with Dr. Marley Bunch herself to hear about how her work centers historically marginalized voices and perspectives. Later on, we're speaking with Michaela Ross and Munira Nuru, two of Dr. Bunch's former students, about the impact she had on their lives as students and Black women.
For her, it was really important for us to understand advocacy, and she modeled it so well. She didn't put anything together, she just planted the seed and watered it.
Dr. Marley Bunch, thank you so much for joining me on Dialogue today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here with you. I am an educator, an author, a lifelong student, and a keeper of stories.
First, I want to talk about The Magnitude of Us. Your book examines history and stories in the classroom to create culturally responsive learning spaces. Can you please tell listeners what is a culturally responsive learning space?
Culturally responsive teaching really started with Gloria Ladson Billings, and then there's been lots of different evolutions and iterations of it. Zaretta Hammond is another person who have evolved it, also like Goldie Muhammad. So I think originally it was the idea of when you're in the classroom and you have students from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds, how do you create lessons and activities that acknowledge the differences amongst your students and helps to kind of allow students to have what we, you know, the saying of windows and mirrors. They can see themselves in the classroom, and then they can also see others. I think that that's a wonderful place to start. I extend that a little bit into this idea of community immersion, because I think learning to celebrate those things, not just tolerate differences in our cultures and backgrounds and lives, is really, really important. And I think one of the ways that I've learned from the women of my research that you do that is by being in community with other people, right? There's such a huge difference between practice and pedagogy in the classroom, and then this idea of like immersion. And I talk about it a little bit in the book. Like my two of my children went to a French immersion school, elementary school. And I remember just being astounded that they would have kindergarten students who would have classes in French all day long, right? There was one class that was in English and everything else was in French. And I really just thought, how are these kids who've never known this language going to function and do well in their learning? And they did because of that immersion piece, right? You are in it. It is every day. It is a part of your life. It just becomes integral into who you are and what you do. And so I think if we can think about culturally responsive teaching and learning and acknowledging and celebrating and being willing to learn about other perspectives as a community act, as an immersive act, I think then it becomes something that we can sustain versus doing it just, you know, to check a box.
Another huge part of your work and research is the UNHUSH framework. Can you break that down to us a bit?
So again, those principles were inspired by my research and the women who kind of paved the way and taught between the 1950s and the 1970s. And so it's with this idea of embedding principles that help to unhush us or unhush silenced or typically marginalized stories and experiences. And so the U is... the U and the N means that we are uniting for collective effort. The N means we're naming our positionality, which is, you know, kind of acknowledging your own lens, your own lived experience, and how that impacts others and your students and the way that you perceive information. And then the main kind of central part, that H-U-S-H, stands for histories, unlearning, stories, and healing. So how can we use histories and stories? How can educators work to unlearn misinformation, use reflection as a way to better our craft and what we do as teachers with our students? And then I think the ultimate goal is that we move towards healing and better kind of bridge building with one another to form relationships.
Do you think sometimes teachers have this superiority, like God complex, when they're in the classroom, that it's that maybe they just want to teach and talk at students rather than also having an open space to learn from students?
Yes. And I, in my own kind of learning and growth in education, I can't remember. I've heard it so many times, but there's some magic number, and I don't remember what the magic number is, but students cannot retain information for more than an extended period of time. And so it's been suggested when I started out that teachers not speak for more than, I don't remember what it was, like 10 or 15 minutes max. And so this idea of kind of dismantling the teacher at the center of the room, lecturing, I don't think that that's what's best for students. And I don't think that we are in with technology and everything going on in this world, I think we reach students better when we allow them to kind of be the center of the classroom. I talk about that in the book, about being a lighthouse teacher. I think my students have taught me well that you are the most impactful when you just serve as a guide. We want students to be able to analyze and have autonomy and figure things out on their own.
Part of the UNHUSH framework is that last letter, H. The last component is healing. What new opportunities for healing and reconciliation can be created through this awareness in the UNHUSH framework?
Healing, at least for me, and I think my students would agree, comes through connection and dialogue. And being in a space, I hate to say safe space because I feel like that word is really overused, but I think if you ask most students, like, where were you able to kind of reconcile with yourself and find important connections with others? I think safety or comfortable spaces where we feel like we can be vulnerable, we can show up as our true selves, we can be all of our identities. I think that moves us towards the ability to connect with other people and also to know ourselves better.
Like you've said, the impact of Black female educators from the 1950s to the 1970s is what inspired you to write this book. What was the magnitude of their teachings?
That title, I think, is so important, right? It's actually from a Gwendolyn Brooks, who's a poet, quote that says, "We are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond." And so I think for me to come across these stories of these incredible Black educators, I mean, they just became my North Star. You never heard them, whether it was before desegregation or after. They never differentiated between my white students. I've always wanted to be a teacher. I loved my students. And then I think that community piece, that really embodies this idea of like the magnitude of us. And in segregated schools in the Jim Crow South, what these women were able to do, despite not having equal resources, they really leveraged this idea of community, coalitions, working collectively to not only get through those difficult times, but to make sure that students weren't shortchanged in their educations.
If everyone in America was able to understand that the history of African Americans is the history of America, how do you think that this would change the world and the education system today?
I love the way that Lonnie Bunch, he's the secretary at the Smithsonian Museums, and when you hear him speak about Black history, he always starts it with saying, like, Black history is everyone's history, right? It's our country's history. And I think that in and of itself is so powerful. And if people could embrace that idea and be open to that, I think we could see such important changes in the classroom. And namely, I think for young Black educators entering the field and our Black students to see themselves, I think that representation piece matters so much. It matters to see people that look like you. It matters to learn about your history and have it be celebratory and honest. I think a lot of times, you know, when we think about what Black history looks like in traditional classrooms, it is the tragic portrayal of Black history and Black communities. And so understanding the importance of education throughout Black history in Black communities that came before us, I think that piece could really shift the narrative, especially again for our Black and Brown students, to understand education has always been important, has always been formative. Their history is rich and beautiful and steeped in education.
Do you think certain aspects of today's education system have failed us, especially Black and Brown students?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, yes. I think the system was never built for us. And I think we still see aspects of that today. We see it in assessment. We see it in our textbooks that are inaccurate or leave out certain histories and stories. We see it in the way that districts draw boundaries and how that's tied to socioeconomics and neighborhoods. And so all of those things are because of the origins of the system and the way it was designed.
You're listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Right now, we're in conversation with Dr. Marley Bunch. She's a scholar, educator, and U of I alum. We're speaking with her about her recent work and latest book, The Magnitude of Us. She explains how educators can better center historically marginalized voices and perspectives in their work. Stay with us on this dialogue. Dr. Bunch, what advice would you have for young educators who are entering this field?
Yeah, I think I would first just say we need you and thank you, you know, for being here and for taking on this important career. And then I would just, I think, share the reminder that you are not alone. I think that that's one of the things that I also learned from my research is historically, you're not alone. There's all this beautiful ancestral history that's, you know, in your rearview mirror. And to find find your people, find your mentors, find those affinity spaces that can support you and encourage you and carry you through kind of the ebbs and flows that come along with teaching. And I would also say that your students are going to someday remind you of why you made this choice. Even research shows all students need to see teachers that are different than them. So teaching is one of the hardest but most rewarding aspects that I've encountered in my life.
Education runs in your lineage, and you are carrying this torch and carrying the legacy of your ancestors in education as well. What is the legacy that you feel is continuing to being built via you or just in education in general?
There's a word called Sankofa, a Ghanaian word.
Yeah.
That means like, do not be afraid to go back to the past and fetch what is needed. And the symbol of it is a bird with its neck kind of turned behind. And I love that. And that image is actually in the book. And I think that that probably sums up the best answer to what you just asked. I think reclaiming those stories, making sure we always have threads of the past and what we do currently is such an important kind of North Star. It's such an important guide for how we face the future. And I always, when I think about my work as an educator and as an advocate, I always think about not only my ancestors, but how do I make my students proud, my family proud, my mentor, you know, Dr. Spann, how do I carry those legacies through me? And I think I do it through my teaching and the relationships that I build with others. And then for me, I think just always finding ways to keep stories of our ancestors present and alive is so, so important to one of the ways that I can carry through kind of that legacy.
You're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Stay with us after this short break on Dialogue. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. We're continuing our conversation on the work of Dr. Marley Bunch. She's an author, education advocate, and lifelong teacher. We just spoke with Dr. Bunch herself about her educational philosophy, her new book, and her research. Now we're hearing from two of her students, Michaela Ross and Munira Nuru, about the profound impact that having a mentor like Dr. Bunch and an educator in their lives has had on them.
We were all across the spectrum of how to have those boundaries, how to talk about it. Ms. Bunch could see it. And so what she did is she allowed us to express it first and, you know, create that space where we could talk about it. And then for her, it was really important for us to understand advocacy. And she modeled it so well. She didn't put anything together. She just planted the seed and watered it.
Michaela and Munira, thank you so much for having this dialogue with me. I'll kick it off to Michaela. Why did you first feel connected to Dr. Bunch as a student?
It was our first Black teacher ever. I have never had that experience. And for me, I've never seen someone look exactly like me, but like I looked at her and I was like, this is me looking in a mirror, like when I'm older. And I think for me, I felt seen without even her saying anything. And I've never had that experience before. I'm more quiet, and anyone that's quiet, she lifted their voices. And so as someone that's really quiet, it was the only teacher that saw everybody. I described it in some of my writing in her book of like holding up mirrors. And that's what it felt like. She always held up a mirror, and it was, I saw myself not just in her, but in the work that we did in her class. Like I got to know myself way deeper than any other teacher I ever experienced.
Munira, when you were Dr. Bunch's student, how did her classroom feel different versus other teachers and how they taught the curriculum in their classrooms?
Like when it was safe, when you would enter the room or the classroom, it kind of felt like a big hug, or at least like you felt like there was support, like immediate attention, immediate support. Like this was somebody who was present But beyond that, like, I feel like a lot of it was introspective, having discussions with peers who've lived different experiences than yourself in a, you know, area that doesn't necessarily reflect you, allows for growth, also allows for there to be like this bridging of perspectives. For me, at least, like, I am a Black person, I'm a Black Muslim woman, but there had been like a lot of times where my hijab took precedent over my race. It was almost like if I was Muslim, I couldn't be Black. So like explicitly stating that I am a Black Muslim woman and I am not going to accept comments about my faith, about my race, or about my, you know, gender, that wasn't something that I thought I had to explicitly make clear. But I learned over time that not everybody lives the same shared experience. And even though I'm living my life and I'm leading my life in the way that I hope to, it's not safe enough to be assumed from everybody. And that's kind of like strengths that I don't think, like, I think it has to be taught.
Michaela, I'll kind of revert back to you. It sounds like Dr. Bunch has helped you find identity and also become an advocate within social and racial justice. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There was so many things that went on for Manira, me, a lot of students, and we were all across the spectrum of how to have those boundaries, how to talk about it. Ms. Bunch could see it. And so what she did is she allowed us to express it first and, you know, create that space where we could talk about it. And then for her, it was really important for us to understand advocacy. And she modeled it so well. She didn't put anything together. She just planted the seed and watered it. Like, we all had different seeds in all of us, and she knew how to water each plant in a way. And for me, I need a lot of water in a sense. I need a lot more confidence to talk about it. Because for me as a biracial Black woman, I felt invalidated to talk about my experience. I felt like it wasn't real compared to darker skinned women. And for me, I just held it in out of what I thought was respect, when really I was not exploring who I am, you know, at that time. So Ms. Bunch really helped me feel confident in owning my experience, that and also coming forward and how to respectfully share it in that way. So for us, it was all the collective stories. She networked with all the people we needed and she brought them to us. She showed us strategic ways of sharing our voice. And that was never a thought to me before. So for her, I think it's that support of each person's experience. She knows they're different and doesn't invalidate each person. Mm-hmm. She gave us the necessary tools and she always amplified the voice and she was there as support. And she always got us in rooms that we needed to be in or that would grow us.
Coming to terms with your own identity, with being a biracial Black woman, how did you learn over time to raise your voice and ask questions in the room?
I think every phase of my life, I'm relearning it in a sense, like another angle. I realized that I never brought it to my parents. Like, the reason why I never spoke of it is because at home, I didn't have someone that looked exactly like me to validate it. My mom, she's white, didn't grow up in any urban environment. And so for her, she would even say things, just not understanding. Things would just kind of go over her head. She didn't know how to see things intentionally. She knew her kids were Black and she protected us, but she couldn't, you know, in a way that she understood it. So I couldn't confide in her. And then my dad, total opposite side of the spectrum, he is almost in his 70s this year. And so he grew up in the 50s. He grew up with segregated schools. You know, he had a whole different lifestyle where he didn't have a lot to grow up with and, you know, was the first one to go to college and all these things. So he kind of shared his story that was very different. And for me, I was like, well, it's not that bad. I have it so much better. I shouldn't share. And it was kind of like that expectation to be kind of like tough it out, like don't cry about it. People are going to say what they're going to say. So for me, I just kept it in every day. And when people would say different slurs or in saying like you're biracial, you shouldn't, you know, feel some type of way. You can't handle a joke. It was more of that. Some teachers would say some things, but that was mostly kind of my experience. If it was always a joke undertone. So for me, I was like, well, I need to take it as a joke. And whenever I talked to Ms. Bunch, she was like, excuse me, like, this is not a joke. This is not a joke. Like, someone did this to you. Someone said this to you. and you didn't do anything. I was like, well, I thought that's what I was supposed to do. So I had to unlearn and relearn at the same time. And for me, it was getting comfortable of sharing with my own family what was going on. Ms. Bunch was offering a safe space through writing. For me, I couldn't really verbalize it. So writing it out, sharing my story in poems was how I first expressed like both my dad and my mom's experience and how, you know, mine fit into that. Now it's one of my passions to do writing and do spoken word one day. And it's taken a lot of confidence going through the years of navigating it now as an adult. But it started with Ms. Bunch and started with writing, started with owning my voice on paper, started with getting everything out instead of holding it in.
Both of you have learned so much from Dr. Bunch, and it seems like you carry these lessons with you in your personal life. How do you continue to carry on these lessons and the legacy of being a student to Dr. Bunch?
It kind of happens through leadership. So first and foremost, like kind of the things that I recognized, it was the shared connection of just recognizing I'm with like-minded people who are open to listening. And I try to recreate that in every kind of setting that I currently have. So like if I'm in class, if I'm at school, then I'm looking for those people who are going to challenge me, who are going to ask me questions, who are going to sort of like pick my brain, push and prod, whatever it may be, to get me to understand whatever it may be. And then beyond that, like recognizing that every person has like a purpose. And that includes me. I think sometimes I exclude myself from that. I like to lead with that understanding that I have my why, they have their why. Even if they're not the exact same, our goals might be. Understanding that there is complexity within humanity and life in general, in every area. I see it the most in healthcare because that's the field that I want to enter. But it really, that same complexity, that same understanding, and that same kind of rule is something that I see when I'm at the coffee shop just ordering something. And I, you know, like I'm recognizing that the barista has a stutter, and being able to like put two and two together, like I was saying, like kind of critically thinking about it and being like, oh, like they're not just delaying their speech, like they have a speech impediment, and being patient with them because I've now recognized like this is their life experience. This is something that they deal with through and through. And I don't know necessarily what that means to them. Like if I'm more patient, but I know like they're human, I'm human, they have a reason they're here and I have a reason I'm here, and I don't want to make anything worse for them because I know what that feels like. And so like sort of carrying that out and leading by example, lifelong learners are special type of person. And this is where the tears come. I think like in a lot of ways, she inspires me in so many ways, but I think like the main way is that this continuation of her love and passion to teach, educate herself, and then to teach and learn, and recognizing the connection between the two it's so special. And it's something that I like also aspire to be like. And so sort of carrying that out and leading by example. And it goes to show that she inspires me to continue to learn because I love to learn, not because it'll, you know, get me to the next place in life. It's because I genuinely love it, and that should only ever be like the reason as to why somebody explores something or continues to aspire for it. I really want to like emphasize how grateful I am to have her as both a mentor and a sponsor.
Thank you so much for joining me on the Dialogue Show. I appreciate all of you, and this was such a beautiful conversation.
What beautiful legacies I have in them. Like, so proud of both of you. Really, really.
Dr. Bunch, as you listen to your students, how does this make you feel?
I think I learned to be the leader and the educator I am because of them, allowing me to be continuously find aspects of myself, and I've learned so much from them. And I think sometimes as teachers, we forget how much we have to learn from our students, but they're such great examples of those possibilities that are there within our students if we just are open to it and give up that control in our classroom.
We've heard from your mentor, We've heard about your own work, your own research, and your former students. What is your hope for the teachers of today's classrooms to learn from your book and to learn from all of the lessons and frameworks from past Black female educators in America?
My goal when I wrote it was to not only write it for current teachers, but to also include pieces for pre-service teachers, because I think when we talk about equity, a lot of times we forget that equity also has to happen in our teaching programs and the way that we extend support and mentorship to new teachers entering the field, especially teachers, Black and Brown teachers, who we know we need more of and who often don't stay in the field for very long. So at the end of every chapter, there's a special section for pre-service and new teachers. I think it really makes it reasonable and simplifies putting this idea of culturally responsive and equitable teaching into action. So there's lots of graphics, there's lesson plans. My students helped to write one of the chapters. So there's a chapter that's really in the voice of students, because I think sometimes we hear that better as educators. And then the lesson plans are all different age. We have elementary, middle school, college, high school, and every lesson plan was planned with another educator. So I paired with a different educator for each lesson to, again, make sure that I am bringing in this idea of perspective and community, diverse voices and thoughts. And I hope it just provides kind of a guide to help teachers find reasonable ways to implement practices that best serve all of our students.
Where can listeners and teachers find your book?
So the book can be found at Amazon or Teachers College Press. Yeah, it's available to order.
Dr. Marlee Bunch, thank you so much for this incredible dialogue. Thank you for all the work that you're doing in today's classrooms, and we look forward to reading The Magnitude of Us.
Thank you so much.
You can find Dialogue wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. The Dialogue Show is produced by Nidhi Shastri, Penny Bradford, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our News and Public Affairs Director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue's theme song is by Lamont Holden. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.